Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Confession, they say it's good for the soul. This hour, we'll talk about that and the possible legal ramifications of a well-known public confession captured recently on YouTube and viewed some 2 million times since.
Or at least in this video, I know exactly what it means. I'm handing the prosecution everything they need to put me away for a very long time. But I'm willing to take that sentence for just one reason, and that reason is so I can pass this message on to you. I beg you, and I say the word beg specifically, I'm begging you, please don't drink and drive.
That's an excerpt from the confession of Matthew Cordell, who on June 22nd got blind drunk, drove the wrong way on I-670, and headlong into the car driven by 61-year-old Vincent Canzani. Mr. Canzani died from crash-related injuries. WOSU reporter Mandy Trimble has been covering the case. She's here to talk about it now. Welcome to the show, Mandy.
Good morning, Ann.
So Matthew Cordell pled guilty yesterday to aggravated vehicular homicide in a Franklin County courtroom. But it was his second time before a judge. The first time he pled not guilty. Can you tell us what that was about?
Yes. I guess in an effort to speed up this process, his attorneys asked for a special arraignment. Arraignments are generally held 2 days a week, not on the day that his first arraignment was supposed to have been held. It's my understanding after speaking with Judge Julie Lynch, who was going to hear the first arraignment, that it was her impression he expected to plead guilty in front of her that day. But she told a group of reporters that she learned the day of the arraignment that he intended to plead not guilty. And she said it was because she was not willing to give a hard sentence ahead of time to, you know, let them know kind of where she was leaning between this 2 and 8.5 years. Mm-hmm. When she learned he decided to plead not guilty, which is a procedural move in the courts.
Not unusual.
I would venture to say, angered her. She was clearly infuriated in front of the court and decided he would be arraigned in with everyone else the following day.
Why would that infuriate her? Do we know?
I think she felt like if someone who, and this is just from a conversation with her, mm-hmm. that someone who, you know, wanted to go ahead and take responsibility for one's actions, like Matthew Cordell, that he was willing to accept whatever sentence.
Whomever was dishing it out.
Right. And it came to her knowledge that he wanted to know what he was going to be sentenced. She wasn't willing to do that, and she indicated most judges aren't willing to show their hand prior to sentencing. So she decided to call it off that day.
She also has a reputation as being a tough sentencer.
She does. So what happens if someone pleads not guilty when they expect to plead guilty later? A new judge is drawn out of 16 judges. So in that essence, Matthew Cordell likely would have gotten another judge. He could have gotten Judge Lynch again, but the likelihood would have been one, I believe, out of 16. I think that's how many judges are down there in mm-hmm. common pleas.
And it would have been somewhat contrived if he had at that point.
Yes, she kind of was right along the line of indicating that Cordell's attorneys were judge shopping, which is out. It's
unethical.
Unethical and banned by the courts.
Okay,
they've denied that, but that's what she alluded to in the conversation.
The thing is that what they did do by him pleading not guilty, even though he intended to plead guilty in the eventually, is not unusual.
No, it's not. It's a very common procedural move. I've been to many arraignments, and it happens in most of them, I would say, that I've been to. And it's just, in essence, to get a judge, get a trial date or a hearing date. So it's quite common. It's
I'm talking with Mandy Trimble of WOSU. We're talking about the confession of Matthew Cordell and a subsequent plea of guilty to aggravated vehicular homicide. If you have a question or comment about the case, we're going to turn to the issue of confession, because, of course, the reason why we're talking about this is because of the now infamous confession that he posted, or that was posted on YouTube 2 weeks ago. So if you have a question or comment about the case itself, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mandy, the police already were on the case by the time of Cordell's confession, preparing charges, right?
That's correct. They were, Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien said that he was a suspect all along. He was taken to the hospital at the scene of the crime. There were traffic cameras. There were other cars involved in the accident who narrowly missed hitting him. So he was a suspect all along. They were waiting for toxicology reports to come back, blood, alcohol level tests to come back, and they also sent off for a drug screen. So according to Ron O'Brien, I mean, there was always the intention to indict him. In Ron O'Brien's words, it was a slam dunk case, regardless of this YouTube confession.
Yeah, the alcohol, blood alcohol level, I think 0.19, I want to say. 0.18?
More than twice the legal limit.
More than twice the legal limit, yeah. But no drugs.
No drugs.
Okay. And what he admitted to in the confession was drinking so heavily,
yes.
He blacked out.
Yes.
Apparently doesn't remember what he did, and entering 670 going the wrong way. The world took note on September 3rd when Cordell posted that confession on YouTube. What were the reactions by law enforcement, especially Franklin County Prosecutor Ron O'Brien?
You know, I asked him that. I wondered whether he took that as a sincere confession, and he said he did. He felt like Cordell was plagued with guilt, as, you know, one would expected, you know, would be expected to feel if they had killed someone. And he felt it was sincere. He did not think it was an effort to get a lighter sentence. He felt it was genuine.
And, you know, when these kind of things happen, or when someone murders somebody, we always want to know why. What happened? How did it happen? And he really gave us a satisfying look at what the process was that brought him to that place. He described in great detail how much he was drinking and why.
Mm-hmm. I think it was made known yesterday that in court, the night that the accident happened, he was quite belligerent when he was confronted by, it was either police or a hospital employee who said, "You've killed someone." And he was in denial, refused to give, you know, blood alcohol. Authorities had to get a warrant to get blood. I'm sorry, not blood alcohol, to give a blood sample. But I think once he was in treatment, and that's kind of when he switched gears and said, I did do this.
In the video, he suggested that his lawyers, or some lawyers, some high-powered lawyers had told him, not his lawyers that he has now, had told him that he might get off if they could get his blood work thrown out. Was that the case? What do we make of that?
I never posed that particular question to either of his attorneys, George Breitmeyer or Martin Midian. I didn't talk to them about that specifically. I can tell you that Ron O'Brien said with the blood test that there was no way that, you know, he wasn't guilty of this crime. Now, procedurally, perhaps if the warrant hadn't been given, and I mean, I'm not a lawyer, mm-hmm. but I could see where there might be a procedural move that something could get thrown out. It's happened before.
Mm-hmm.
But the evidence was there that he was definitely above the legal limit the night that it happened.
Which is the aggravated part of the vehicular homicide, is that fact that he had been drinking.
Right.
Now the case is before another judge. Tell us about that judge and what's next.
He's been on the bench for years. I don't know his record as far as kind of how he leans in DUI cases. Mm-hmm. I know that Judge Lynch has been known to be very severe, I guess you could call it, for lack of a better word, in her sentencing in these kinds of cases. I don't know about Judge Feist. I do know he's been on the bench a very long time, though.
And do we know if Judge Feist has seen the video?
I don't know. I know that Judge Lynch had not. The day that he was set to be arraigned the first time, she said she had not seen, you know, the video. Didn't know really very much about the case. Whether Judge Feist has, I don't know.
Do we know if the judge can look at the video and consider it in determining the sentence?
I think they can. I mean, Judge Lynch said to a group of reporters that day that she postponed that hearing. She said, I don't know if I will watch the video. I think it's at their discretion whether to. I'm sure it's part of evidence. I don't know, whether he'll choose to do that or not. But I think they can, from what she indicated.
You've been covering courts now for some years. Mm-hmm. What do you make of the confession? How did it strike you as a journalist?
It struck me as sincere when I first saw it. I thought, wow, that's, I guess you could say honorable that somebody would come forth and say, I want to take responsibility for my actions, especially someone so young. I mean, their brains aren't even fully developed at age 22. So I thought it was sincere. In moving forward, however, in the procedure, the court procedure, and what I learned with, well, you're not going to tell me how long my sentence is going to be, I think that kind of negates that sincerity a little bit.
A little cynicism creeping in.
A little bit. And then the judge wondering whether these attorneys were judge shopping, which they've denied, it kind of makes you wonder how sincere all of this really is.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher. We're talking about the value of confession. First, we wanted to review the case of Matthew Cordell, who confessed via YouTube in an infamous video. Now it's been viewed about 2 million times, probably more by now. It was done through the auspices of Because I Said I Would, which is a organization, a nonprofit. It's just an organization created to make the world a better place, mm-hmm. and do so by having people fulfill promises.
Right. It was a guy from the Powell area originally. His dad died, mm-hmm. and he kind of set this up in his memory because he said, my dad was no one extraordinary other than he always kept his promises. So I think his name is Alex Sheen. He was the one who set up this Because I Said So website. Mm-hmm. And I think that Cordell reached out to him and they agreed to produce this video.
If somebody wants to learn more about Alex Sheen and the Because I Said I Would organization that he created in his father's memory, I did interview him last October on one of the Tech Tuesday shows. You can go back into our archives and check that out if you'd like. We will return and continue our conversation in just a few minutes. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Matthew Cordell's confession has sparked many conversations about how the court should handle his case. Joining us now by phone is former Common Pleas Judge and former Court of Appeals Judge Mike Close, who's now a lawyer in private practice in Columbus. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, Ann. Glad to be here.
That segment of the YouTube video was pixelated, and also the voice was distorted. It was at the beginning of the video. The YouTube method is new, but confession is not. Does the delivery of the confession change anything when it comes to the delivery of justice?
I don't think so. I was thinking about this morning on the way in, that confessions years after the past are not something new. Confessions after the event are nothing new. I think we've had people show up at police stations confessing to murders that happened 30 years ago that they were not even a suspect in. So in that regard, the media certainly is different. The way it's delivered is different. Its preservation as evidence is different. but what they're doing is not different.
As a former judge, what do you make of Cordell's decision to go public like this?
You know, it's hard to gauge at this point what was really going through his mind. Certainly, he was under investigation for the offense. It is more than likely that at some point that investigation would have been led to charges being filed. I would certainly hope that what was behind it was, as he would claim, or at least as I've read he claim, I have not listened to the tape myself, that that he was in an attempt to get some focus, some discussion on how senseless this was. But who knows? It very well could have been that, well, I'm going to be charged anyway. Maybe I get ahead of the game by coming in and making the confession now.
As a lawyer, is it something that you would advise one of your clients to do?
No. I think on almost, there's an old saying that by many prosecutors that the prisons are full of guys that couldn't keep their mouth shut. I know that's crass, but the reality is that if an attorney is going to be able to do anything there is to be done for his client, it doesn't help to have the client out front like this. For instance, at this point, Judge Feist is going to make a decision someplace between 2 and 8.5 years in prison. If the client goes in and talks to the lawyer in advance, even before the indictment or charge is filed, it's certainly possible that something can be worked out to get away from the upper end of that range before the indictment's ever filed.
But that was kind of taken away, that opportunity, with the YouTube video.
Certainly. You know, when you've got a confession, so to speak, that is out there for everybody to see, that's in the public domain, awful hard to take it back.
As a judge, would you feel a different? I know that when you were a judge, there weren't telephones yet, right? No, I'm just kidding. You get the joke.
Ann, I just say, yeah. We didn't have anything but dial phones.
But the pressure that would be brought, would you feel pressure from this when you have 2 million hits on a YouTube video like that?
As a judge?
Yeah.
No.
Okay.
You know, the reality is you've got sentencing guidelines of what you're supposed to do with case. You get the advantage of a complete pre-sentence report, which the probation department over in Common Pleas Court is busy at work on right now, so that you're going to have all the information in the world you need. I'm not saying that you don't subtly feel some pressure sometime if there's everybody in the community is out to hang somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But, this kind of thing and how many hits doesn't make any difference. It's like saying 2,000 or 4,000 or 800,000 people read the newspaper. So what?
I read that Judge Feist has said that he will view the YouTube confession during the sentencing phase. What would he be looking for? Isn't true remorse, if that's what he's looking for, always subjective?
True remorse is always subjective. But I think if you look at the combination of what the pre-sentence report shows, the judge's impression of what the confession was all about, that's what you pay judges to do, is to be able to make those kind of subjective judgments.
I would imagine what I would want to do is find out if what Matthew Cordell said in the video is true. Was he suffering from depression? Did he get in fights a lot? Kind of verify, or was he dramatizing his life?
That's exactly what will happen with the pre-sentence investigation. I would expect that when that report comes back, the judge will be able to verify those things that are verifiable in the YouTube tape.
What about?
And I know I'm probably using the wrong word to say tape, but
no, I know I do.
I'm an old guy.
Tape recorder. Yeah. What I didn't expect from, I was listening to it for the first time, and when it went into the area of I'm doing this because I want to save a future victim. I'm doing it to try to. I'm begging you not to drink. He turned it into, a public,
public
service announcement, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. What about that aspect of it?
To the extent that the judge believes that that's sincere, that certainly can be taken into consideration in the sentencing. The reality is this is such a serious offense that I don't know that the judge has got a lot of leeway as to what he's going to do, but it certainly, if the young man is sincere that he did this in order to attempt to deter others from doing it, then part of the objective criteria we use in imposing a sentence has been accomplished, and that would mitigate towards a lesser sentence.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Mike Close. He's a lawyer in private practice now, but a former common pleas judge and a former court of appeals judge. We're talking about the Matthew Cordell case. He's the fellow that went posted on the web the YouTube video of his confession in the death of Vincent Canzani, 61-year-old Vincent Canzani, in June. Mike Close, some have suggested that if it appears that Cordell gets a break, a lighter sentence because of the confession, that there will be a spate of such confessions. And as a lawyer, is it something like, I've already asked you, would you recommend it? But do you see that happening?
No. And the reason is that most places, you know, we spend too much time watching CSI. Most cases, I think, are ultimately resolved because a defendant or a person of interest or whatever makes a comment that ties him to the crime that would not have happened if he had not opened his mouth. And to the extent that people understand that and keep their mouth shut, it doesn't make the police and prosecutor's job any easier. So I would not expect this to lead to a spate of confessions of, you know, from unknown people of unknown crimes. Or even known crimes.
Listeners, if you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page. What do you think of the Matthew Cordell confession in the YouTube video? How did it make you feel? What do you think he should get? Should it be taken into consideration in the sentencing process? Give us a call, 614-292-8513.
And let me just interject one other thing in response to your last question too.
Yeah.
The reality is that no matter what else happened, this young man is still going to prison.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that he is still going to prison will be a deterrent, I believe, to some other people that might consider likewise stepping forward and confessing to something.
Hmm. And do you think you've met a lot of criminals in your life? Do you think that confession does him some good as a person?
I think it has to. You know, no matter which of the major religions that we belong to, atonement, saying you're sorry, reconciliation, by whatever name you call it, is part of the whole fabric. And to the extent that you never say you're sorry, there are those that would believe that you can never be forgiven. So I think certainly as far as being a human being and what he's doing for his own soul, so to speak, that being willing to take responsibility. You know, the whole legal system, as hard as it is to believe sometimes, is based on an ethical structure that is kind of the collective conscience of a people developed over eons. And that collective conscience includes the necessity to atone, to ask for forgiveness. And to the extent he does that, the system itself recognizes that if you take responsibility for your action, and well, in the federal system in particular, just taking responsibility for your actions is sufficient to, in some regards, mitigate part of the penalty.
Steve in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Steve.
Yeah, I have a question about the facts of the crash. If it was a fatal collision, how did he leave without it being absolutely certain that he did it?
How can that happen, Mike Close?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, I have not watched the tape, so all I know is what I've read in the newspaper, and I know that it was a head-on crash. I would presume that at some point he would have had to have at least gone to the hospital. And I just don't have an answer to that question.
Mandy Trimble?
Okay, there we go. Yeah, he didn't actually leave this scene of the crash on his own. He was taken to the hospital. He spent some time in the hospital, from what I understand, due to his own injuries. And from what came out in court, he was so inebriated at the time, I don't think he knew what was going on. And when he was presented with that information at the hospital, as I mentioned earlier, he was so belligerent, but he didn't leave the accident, number one,
well,
on his own.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. So he may not have known what hit him, so to speak, at the time, because he had no idea where he was going. He went on an off-ramp to get on, you know, I-670 and was completely going the wrong way.
I would further presume that at some point while he was hospitalized, or even if it was only there for a short period of time, that somebody took a blood draw in order to determine the blood alcohol content. You know, we can't expect the police officer at the scene to be able to make a differentiation between somebody that's in an alcoholic blackout and somebody that suffered a serious injury and is knocked out.
We just don't know anymore, right?
We just don't know.
Mm-hmm. Well, and
so it is not unreasonable to say that maybe they were waiting for the toxicology reports in order to proceed. I just don't know.
And heavens no, he wasn't going anywhere.
Right. Yeah. And his attorney, one of his attorneys mentioned yesterday that he may have suffered some kind of brain injury during the accident, which caused his memory to, you know, to not remember the accident as well.
Well, whether he remembered it or not, the reality is
they
pull him out of the car going the wrong way on a one-way street. Mm-hmm. Once they got their toxicology and know that he was, I think it was 0.19 alcohol content, you know, the conviction or the charge was going to follow at some point.
Right.
Okay, Steve, thanks for that call. We have an email from Anton. He says, I have not viewed the YouTube confession myself, but have heard excerpts on the radio. Does your guest think that the production value, i.e. the melodramatic music playing in the background, speaks to motivation behind putting out this quote-unquote confession?
Because just like the question, the person asking the question, not having listened to it, I don't know, but I know that it's not going to have any impact on Judge Feist.
In the video, Cordell said that some high-powered lawyers, and I don't get the sense that he's referring to the lawyers that are representing him now, that some high-powered lawyers had told him to lie. And I talked to a high-powered lawyer about that, and he said he found it offensive that he said that, and that maybe Cordell should report those lawyers to the bar. What is your reaction?
If a lawyer told him to lie, that a lawyer should be reported to either the Ethics Committee of the Columbus Bar Association or to the Ohio Disciplinary Council. That is totally unacceptable. It is perfectly all right to keep your mouth shut and say to the prosecutor that under our system of laws, you've got an obligation to prove your case against me beyond a reasonable doubt, and I don't have to cooperate with that. But going the next step and saying you should lie is absolutely reprehensible.
April in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, April.
Hi. I just wanted to make a comment in regards to Matthew. And what I want to say is, although I'm glad that he confessed, because it takes a lot of burden off the system, you know, to prove anything, I think he should get the full sentence for what he did.
Why?
I think it was totally irresponsible for him to be out on the road drinking to that degree. And for that reason, he took a life. And I don't think confessing it makes that any less of a crime.
The daughter, thank you, April, for that. Mr. Kanzani's daughter has said, Mandy Trimble, that she doesn't think that the confession, she thinks the confession was the wrong thing to do, that it dragged the family through this again, and doesn't think that it should give him any leeway.
Right. I think that coming out with the confession ahead of time, before I don't think she as an Angela Kanzani, knew that this confession was going online. I think it took Ms. Kanzani by surprise. And certainly I can only imagine that it would dredge up, you know, emotions that just so recently happened. She said in a news report that she didn't necessarily mind him coming out against drinking and driving later, but this confession so soon and before he had been charged, she felt like it was contrived and in an effort to, you know, get a bid for a lesser sentence.
Okay. All right. Well,
what you hire Judge Dave Feist to figure out.
Yep. That's what this guy in the robes is supposed to get
you know,
paid.
And Dave has been on the bench for 25 years and has been a very good judge. You know, you got a good one there making this decision.
What about the issue of the judge shopping that's been put out there when he pleaded not guilty in the arraignment and then came back the next day?
Well, in the first place, I don't remember in my almost 40, well, actually I've been in the system for 42 years, I don't remember guilty pleas and arraignments ever happening.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not set up for it that way. The system would say that if you plead guilty in arraignment that you're going to get the assigned judge will be the duty judge for that week. There is not judge shopping in the context that if you enter the not guilty plea, the next thing that happens is by lot, one of the 17 judges in the common pleas court is drawn to hear your case. So if they wanted to avoid Judge Lynch, yeah, you can do it by entering a not guilty plea, but you've got a just as good a chance of getting her back as anybody else by the luck of the draw.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Mike Close, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Anytime, man.
Appreciate it, Mike Close. He's a lawyer in private practice now, but also a former common pleas judge and a former court of appeals judge. Coming up, we're going to continue the conversation about the issue of confession as a moral act. If you have a comment about that, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Check out our Facebook page. Go online there and post your question or comment there. What do you think about the YouTube confession of Matthew Cordell? Should he get a break? Should he not get a break? How did you feel when you heard it? Give us a call. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Yesterday, Matthew Cordell pled guilty to aggravated vehicular homicide in the June death of 61-year-old Vincent Canzani. But the courtroom scene was upstaged a few weeks ago when a video of Cordell's confession went viral on YouTube.
On that particular night, I made a mistake and got in my truck, completely blacked out, and decided to try to drive home. I ended up going the wrong way down the highway, directly into oncoming traffic, and I struck a car.
Confession is said to be good for the soul. Joining us now to talk about the religious history, the moral history of the confession, and the moral implications in today's society is the Reverend Dr. Henry Langneck. He's a professor at Trinity Lutheran Seminary in Bexley. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Still with us, Mady Trimble of WOSU as well. We have an email from a listener, and then I want to go right to a caller first. The listener says, will anyone else be held accountable for failing to stop someone so inebriated from getting behind the wheel? And that's something that you wanted to talk about as well, Johanna.
Indeed. I used to be a bartender, and we were trained in order to go through the process of evaluating someone if they've been heavily drinking and to make sure that we don't serve them anymore. And I don't know if he had gone to a friend's place or if it was bar hopping, but those individuals should be also held responsible. And in addition, I would also like to comment that what I've heard on the radio as far as with his confession, it sounds very contrived, and it's like he's acting in order to make him look better than, you know, oh, I'm a good soul and I'm trying to do the good thing.
Mm-hmm.
If he has an alcohol problem, why hasn't he gone through AA?
Okay. Mady Trimble, anything brought up about that?
I hadn't heard anything about further charges holding bartenders or proprietors, you know, responsible for that. He was not at a friend's house. He was, from what I understand, in the Park Street Arena District area, as he mentioned in the video, hopping from bar to bar, going from bar to bar.
Okay. What is confession at its base? what does the word come from, and what does it mean, and what's the point of it all?
Well, I don't know Latin, so I'm going to stay away from where the word comes from. But I would say that the drive to confession, the deepest motivation, I think, if it's a matter of guilt, where you've got this burden of having done something wrong, that you want someone in authority or somebody with credibility to hear and understand what you've done and not reject you, to stay in relationship with you, and then help release you from unrealistic consequences. Like if you're afraid because I did this, I'm going to go to hell, or I'm afraid I did this, my life is over, and then help you face with courage and hope the consequences that you do have to face. I would also, the other level or layer of confession would be having to do with shame, which is where you, the burden is the kind of person you are. So like if you're a greedy person or a prideful person, or in the case of Matthew Cordell and his thing, you know, understanding that you have a addiction problem, that you, again, you want to hear, you want someone to hear you and understand you and not reject you, stay in relationship with you, give you assurance that God thinks you have value, and then help you start to sort of sort out, you know, how you get connected to resources and people that can help you deal with that sense of yourself as not a good person.
Is it a common component of religious life? We know there's elements of it in the Jewish religion, Protestantism. What is it pretty much across the board?
Yeah, certainly in the Jewish tradition, Roman Catholic tradition, Orthodox tradition, and the Reformed mainline, Episcopal, Lutheran, and then as you move into Presbyterians, Methodists, and more free church traditions, that the prevalence of it may diminish, but it's certainly in the sort of those mainline traditions, it's a factor. We, in our own liturgies, we have the option to do a corporate confession every Sunday,
What do you mean by corporate?
Well, so everyone in there's a ritual of where the presider says some words about our sort of state of sin, and then individuals are invited to reflect on their own either guilt or shame. And then a pronouncement is made, a redeclaration of our status before God, given by God's grace, that we are still loved by God and in relationship with God, even though we are guilty or shameful. So we have that option every Sunday. Some Lutherans would practice individual confession even, sometimes in sort of an official Roman Catholic sort of way, or the pastor's in a room and people come at a regular time, or in a connection with a counseling situation where you might say, would you like me to hear your confession? If you hear in a counseling situation that someone's burdened by something they've done or the way they feel they are, then we have a resource that allows the pastor to have a little private service of individual confession.
Mandy Trimble, going back to the victim's daughter, one of her problems with this, too, was that it took her by surprise. And it took attention away from the victim and his family.
That's something that she has said over and over, is that, remember, someone died here. That all this media attention surrounding Matthew Cordell's confession has taken away the fact that her father, Vincent Canzani, died that night. And I think all the media attention surrounding this is because it's uncharted waters, at least here in Franklin County. Judge Julie Lynch mentioned that. His attorneys mentioned that they've never had this kind of case before. It's not to say that there aren't vehicular homicides that happened. Judge Julie Lynch mentioned that. What sets this apart is that YouTube confession.
What about the public aspect of it?
Well, I didn't watch the video until this morning, but I heard about it on the news. And hearing about it on the news, I thought that's really gutsy and that's commendable. I agree with the caller earlier, and others have talked about the production values and the sort of, the music kind of drew some of that into question for me. The other thing that surprised me about it, kind of, was that when he sort of turned to the, here's why I'm doing this, he didn't say to unload my guilt or to seek forgiveness from the family or any, it was to make sure that no one else goes out and kills somebody. And I was surprised at that. That was his choice, but a confession, I think, would have turned in that direction a little bit, looking for forgiveness looking for forgiveness either from the family or from the culture or whatever.
I'm not sure if it's true in, every religion, but the confession is usually private.
Yeah, well, in terms of enumerating your own sins,
right.
Yes, that would tend to be private. The corporate would be either, corporate confession would either be where you'd sort of in your own prayer internally,
right.
Or the community might confess to the society for, past crimes, anti-Semitism, or whatever. Yeah, but, but right, the individual naming of sins would normally be done only privately.
So there was an article in the online Daily Beast that talked about the obsession, the confession obsession. That has been triggered by the anonymity of social media. There's all kinds of sites out there now where people are confessing, and then the sites are pretty well managed. I've looked at several of them, and they don't let foul language and trolls on. They want people responding who are listening to them and not rejecting them, but giving them feedback.
Mm-hmm. And I think the effect of that is that's going to be the part of the confessor, what sort of weight they put in the authority of the person who grants absolution or forgiveness, or whether that's what they're looking for. So that that would vary, I would suspect, on what kind of, again, authority or credibility you give to the person on the other end. Well, I mean, there's something about just getting it off your chest. But
right.
In terms of really moving forward, you'd want some kind of response, some kind of relationship.
Listeners, you have a question or comment about this. You want to talk about the online or the video confession of Matthew Cordell for the death of Vincent Canzani in June. Give us a call. What did you think of it? 614-292-8513. Were you moved? Do you think it says something good about Matthew Cordell, or does it make you question him more? 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The Daily Beast writer called the video chilling, and I didn't feel that way about the video. It made me feel sad, I'll say. It made me feel sad just in general, because I hadn't paid attention to the Mr. Canzani's death, frankly. I mean, I remember hearing about it, but that was about it. And it just kind of, and I'm wondering, what are you supposed to feel when you hear something like that? Some people obviously think it's cynical and it made him angry. I didn't really think of it in those terms, but I get that.
He confessed to some criminal acts. I mean, it was pretty open and candid confession to criminal acts, and again, give him some credit for that kind of courage. I mean, yeah, we can interpret it cynically, and there may be good reason to do that. But on the face of it, he confessed to some really awful things, and even to share depression publicly. I mean, that's new. That's not something that people do.
Mm-hmm.
So I give him some credit for that. Again, it's not clear what he was looking for in terms of
who will ever know
relationship with the family or relationship with God or anything, but give him some credit.
I know in reading, I have not spoken with her, but Mr. Canzani's ex-wife, Cheryl Oates, indicated, and she had a different take on this confession than Mr. Canzani's daughter did. I read that she said she respected Cordell for confessing so publicly, and that she felt it took courage to do that. So, you know, even within the same, I guess, familial circle, there are different takes on the confession.
And I, you know, what I would want to say to him, or to if using the video as an exemplar, I'd say that at least the framework of the Christian faith that I live in, there is nothing to fear finally from the truth coming out. That we can go all the way into the depths of depression, of alcoholism, of wrongdoing, and there is a way out. I mean, you might have to go to jail, you might have to make restitution, but that there's nothing to fear from the truth and from digging around in the truth. And I have a pretty firm conviction about that.
Marie, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes, hi. I have two comments. First, I'm Catholic, and so my idea of confession really is that when you commit something like this, his is a mortal sin, he caused the death of someone else, he is separated from God. And the act of confession to a priest who's speaking through God brings you back into the grace of God. And the second point I have to make is I feel like Matthew is in this generation of oversharing. I don't feel like this is a confession at all. They're so used to just sharing every aspect of their lives through social media that this is just was natural to him to say, this is what I did. I don't know that it was actually a confession per se, but especially in the way that he said, and it was mentioned before, that he didn't say, I'm very sorry to the victim, to his family, I feel remorse. He just kind of, you know, public service announcement, don't drink and drive. So that's kind of how I view what this so-called confession was.
Yeah, if I may, and with or without this confession, this YouTube video, I'll say again that Prosecutor O'Brien, there was always an intention of indictment with or without this confession. So some might say, as the caller, this wasn't necessarily a confession because he was implicated in this crime all along.
Right, and what I hear the caller saying too is that we don't know that he was understanding himself to be eternally separated from God until a priest could reconnect. I mean, so in that sense, it's not a technical confession for Roman Catholic understanding.
Right. From
so
that
she's
purpose.
Right on that.
Marie, thank you for your call. Jody in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, Jody.
Hi. I just wanted to address what someone had said previously about having the bartenders, et cetera, responsible for this.
Right.
I don't understand why our society doesn't realize that if you're a grown person, you take responsibility for your own decisions. Those bartenders might have thought that he was getting into a cab. Or if he said that he was bar hopping, as we have said previously, then maybe those bartenders only
sure.
served him one or two drinks.
Yeah, who's to
but
know?
I've
who's
seen,
to, yeah.
I mean, I've seen this happen with drug charges also. You know, because a person rides along with someone to get drugs, they're actually also, they can be found guilty mm-hmm. of a crime because
they were
in the car with them. I think adults should take responsibility for their own choices.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. I have been a bartender. I have served drunk people. I have cut them off, and I have made sure as much as I could that somebody else was driving the car. But you know, point taken, Jody. Thanks a lot for that call. We have an email from Rosemary. She says, in response to the caller who suggested that the young man confess just so he could get off easier, I find that to be a very cynical attitude. It seems these days, no matter what action people take, they can't win. He came forward. He used the media, YouTube, that young people today communicate with. He took responsibility. That is refreshing these days. I applaud his actions, his remorse, his responsibility, and his willingness to take the consequences. So different takes. And it is. It's the medium of the age.
It is. It is. And, you know, I will say that it's a lot of young people within his generation have this sense of entitlement. And for someone who is that young to come forward and, you know, use media for a confession like he did, I guess could be called commendable.
David in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome, David.
Yeah, this is David. I just wanted to say two aspects of confession in my life, and I would say this is in the Lutheran Church and also in a program called Celebrate Recovery, which is a Christian 12-step program. Two aspects of confession to me are, one is self-knowledge, that I acknowledge myself, what have I done that caused pain and suffering? And the other one that's terribly important is healing. That I believe that in confession, God can help us, as it says in the 12 steps, to remove these defects of character that have caused these acts. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, David. And real quick, Jerry, we have about 30 seconds.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the difference between confession and admission.
Okay.
What this kid did was acknowledge he did something wrong. It was an admission. I really don't believe it was a confession.
Okay.
That's a fair point.
Okay, because the police were already, he knew that he was caught.
Right.
So.
A gutsy or a commendable admission, but I take his point. That's a.
Yeah.
The issue of the modus operandi has come up a couple times, and I think it's an interesting question. Generationally, it might not be the way some of us would communicate, but in that generation, I get the exposing themselves too much
mm-hmm.
point.
Well, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to remember the video, but he does not look in the camera and say, I'm talking to the family, to the judge, to my
right.
friends, to the, I mean, so not knowing who his intended audience is, it's kind of hard to know some of what how to parse out what that was about.
Well, thanks for joining us today.
Sure,
appreciate
my pleasure.
It. The Reverend Dr. Henry Langnick, he is a professor at Trinity Lutheran Seminary, and also Mandy Trimble, WOSU reporter. Thanks for staying the hour with us, Mandy.
It's always a pleasure.
And thanks to everybody on all sides, producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurovich, assistant producer Rachel Quimby, production assistants Karam Shaban, Julia Hyder, Andrew Zissler, and Leticia Wiggins. Thanks to the video production by Rich Karsmitsky and Amber Karsmitsky. Alan DeCenzo is the composer of our theme music. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. It's listener-supported WOSU 89.7 and WOSU HD1 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org. 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station, a service of Ohio State University.